Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Today's podcast is brought to you by GoToMeeting.com. And you know, if you aren't using a web conferencing tool, or the service you use is clunky, use my first choice, GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is really easy to use. It turns a call in an instant to an online meeting just with one click. It's affordable, as many meetings as you want for just $49 per month. Very secure, and it substantially reduces meeting-related expenses. You can try GoToMeeting for free for 30 days. If you go to simply the address of gotomeeting.com/podcast, you get 30 free days of unlimited service, and you also get the opportunity to check it out. I highly recommend that we use it for our meetings and our online virtual meetings. Simply go to gotomeeting.com/podcast and go get your 30-day free trial. Well, hello. Welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 147, first week of February 2010, and by golly, it's starting to feel like old times again, isn't it? We are seeing multiple train wrecks across economies and markets throughout the world, and it is getting a little bit tedious watching all of the ripple effects of the outright spending spree that our governments have been on. We're going to talk about that today and also have a lot of technology embedded in the show because our guest today is an expert in the area of technology. His name is Eric Savitz, and he is the technology writer for Barron's Magazine. We've had him on before, and he's a great guest, and he has a great deal of knowledge, and I really believe he's going to give us some good insight because the technology has been really leading this market down along with the banks and the former leaders. We need to find out what's going on, what the great opportunities are moving forward. In addition to that, I want you to write this down and think about this because I know this is something that you want to hear. This is someone who you've asked me for many times, and he's been on the show before. His name is Harry Dent. He's the gentleman who predicted a lot of the things that are going on right now with the markets and the economy. He predicted back in the late 90s that there's going to be an economic collapse coming towards the end of the first decade of 2000. He was right on with that. And beyond that, he wrote a recent book, which really, I guess, expands on that. And it's all about the Great Depression Ahead. And that is a pretty eerie book and an eerie title. And he's projecting that somewhere in the second half of 2010, there'll be a general collapse of the U.S. markets and the global economy. Something that you want to pay attention to. We'll kind of pick it apart next week and pick apart his theory a bit to see if there's any substance to it and find out if there's something that we can glean and learn from our friend Harry Dent. In the meantime, I thought I'd cover a couple of things because the market has been just outright difficult to deal with. If you're a buy and hold a player that made a lot of money through the second part of 2009. Maybe you're rethinking your strategy right now when you see world markets down anywhere from about 4% to about 20% already. We're talking about 5 weeks into 2010. The question is, what's going wrong? So I thought I would do is I made a list of 10 different things that are going on in the economy right now and in the news and in the, I guess, the reasons why the economies are falling apart. And really what's happening in the U.S. as well and why our markets are holding up better than others but still falling apart pretty badly. S&P is down, 4%, 4.5%. The NASDAQ's down about 6%. Small caps down about 5%. So what's going on? When did this all happen? It really, if you think about it, that demarcation point, that really where it all started, we're not really putting any blame on this, but was when we saw the Massachusetts election and the Republican grab a seat. And now Senator Brown, who has recently been installed into office, that was really the point when all of a sudden things started changing pretty dramatically. That was the first thing that happened. And why is that? Because we have now a roadblock for the Republicans to put in front of Democratic initiatives. And that really started to cause a ripple effect because now uncertainty is really throughout the markets. And that's a big, we always talk about that. that uncertainty is pretty much the investor's biggest enemy. The second thing is we have President Obama, right? Isn't he scrambling? I mean, there's nothing worse than seeing our leader kind of grasping at straws, trying to change things in the middle of a direction because all of a sudden we had this situation. Again, we'll blame that on the fact the Republican got the seat for breaking down the supermajority in the Senate. And we clearly see some changes happening. We see Paul Volcker all of a sudden getting the spotlight, coming front and center, maybe pushing Treasury Secretary Geithner to the back where he was going to be possibly under fire. We do predict that if any hedge were going to roll, it's going to be his because of what happened with the whole AIG fiasco. And if you look at – did you see this where in Congress there was a congressional – there was a congressional hearing where they brought they kind of marched in front Geithner and Paulson to testify about what happened with AIG. And it was very clear that neither of them were in charge. Neither of them were in charge during the time when the AIG bailout came. They both covered their tracks pretty well and have some kind of a backstory that they, or maybe even an alibi, you want to call it, that they put together. I mean, pretty ridiculous. But nobody's running the House when one of the biggest payoffs ever happened in modern history or in history ever. The Paul Volcker situation, where you look at the Volcker rule that he announced last week, which is to separate the major commercial banks and separate them from their banking division into banking and trading division. So in other words, there'll be no crossover. Kind of remnants of, or maybe even a revival of the Glass-Steagall Act that was stupidly, very stupidly. I mean, almost you got to scratch your head and wonder what were they thinking when they really, you know, took an act that was not only embedded and doing remarkably well, keeping relative stabilization in the banking sector for many, many years, and they repealed it. I mean, what were they thinking? There's so many times that, I don't know about you, but I wonder, what are they thinking and what were they thinking when they did things like removing the uptick rule or raising the available amount of Freddie and Fannie that they can lend in their ratios or allowing homeowners to basically put nothing down to buy a home. I mean, what were they thinking? It's kind of like a Saturday Night Live skit where, you know, you wonder, what were they thinking? So you have that. The fourth thing was the budget. You can't raise taxes and at the same time say you're cutting spending when you raise the budget by trillions of dollars and at the same time raise the debt ceiling available by, I think it was $1.9 trillion, allowing the government to borrow even more money. And you talk about stopping spending, but at the same time, there's a massive amount of spending in this budget, deficit being driven up, and on top of it, you're going to be taxing everybody to death. This is not the way to spur on growth. We know this. It's proven. And the thing that really is troubling is, I may have mentioned this before, but last week in, I think it was Investor's Business Daily or some other piece that I was reading, it showed that over the last 100 years or so, the people that made up the cabinet and showed how much experience each one of them had, each administration cabinet had, when it comes to looking at their business background, their economics background, etc. The Obama administration has about 10% of all the administration appointees and people involved in the administration giving him all of his guidance that had any kind of professional background in the area of business, et cetera, whereas the lowest one prior to that was, you know, like 55%. That's not a good situation. That is not something that makes me feel really good that they understand what is the inner workings of business, and that probably explains a lot about why we're seeing some of the ridiculousness of the overspending and Keynesian type of debilitating spending that's going on right now that is going to cripple our economy not only in future generations, but in the very short term. So the budget came out, and that was another kind of nail in the market's coffin for the short term. The employment numbers have not looked good any way you want to look at them. And we saw an uptick last week in the initial claims, and that was very surprising to most. We saw an uptick or a miss of the estimates when it came to non-farm payrolls, even though we saw a 9.7% unemployment rate. Now realize, those are different numbers. Those are different. A lot of people think that the employment numbers are all one big package, and they scratch their head and say, wait a minute, we see another 20,000 people are off the payrolls, but how in the world do we have a 9.7% unemployment rate, which is down from 10%. How does it go down when we have more people that aren't working? Well, it's a different survey. The household survey looks at a different grouping of people, so it may, you know, get a bit more volatile and change a bit more readily. It is expected, unless something miraculous happens, that that's going to actually move up over the next number of months. Now, earnings. Earnings when it comes to companies have been coming in better than expected for the most part. Revenues have been, you know, on and off, very spotty when it comes to the revenues numbers. But again, it's from a very low expectation level. Sometimes they call it the bar is very low now to beating earnings. And also what we've seen now is a change in perception. You look at two or three quarters ago, and the idea was that earnings are going to fall off a cliff. They're just not going to be there. So any earnings that were there on a positive side or not as bad as were expected is really a good thing. But at the same time, what we're finding now is that investors are looking for not just not as bad as it was expected or just not okay. They're looking for some real growth drivers to take stocks to a higher level than where they are now, because much of these stocks that had their major runs were on the run because it was expectation of a V recovery. That does not seem very likely under any scenario. We see more like a square root sign, if you think about it, right? You know, you see a kind of a level off, a drop down, a pickup, and then a flat top for a while. That's what it looks like when it comes to the recovery right now. And a lot of that is driven by the fact that in this part of where we are in the recovery cycle, we should have seen a lot more employment. We need at least about 125,000 people, plus or minus, to be employed on a monthly basis in order to actually break even with the employment requirements of our country to see a growth here. That's not happening for some time. The other thing that happened was China. China took a different stance on their overall monetary policy and their loans that they were going to give to people in China for buying homes and really kind of crack down. They made a few different comments that showed that they were getting a little bit more serious on the amount of loans that they were going to give out, because there is a major bubble forming. I mean, there is a incredible run to real estate right now as an investment because there is such an easy monetary policy and loans are so easy to get. And, you know, it's the story that we've heard many, many times about really 2005, 6, 7 in the U.S. Same thing happened in Spain. We see that collapsing right now. I'm going to get to that in a second. So China has started to rein in some of their debt. And at the same time, we look at their stockpiles of whether it's copper or lead or any other metal or coal or all the different commodities they were stockpiling for some time. And they slowed down. Why? Prices have come up a bit. They wanted to get it when it was very low, and they did so very successfully. And maybe they were one of the drivers that was moving the prices up all this time. So China is really the engine of the world right now, because they have just an amazing amount of money that they are using to pick up the global economy. They came out with a GDP print of about 10.5%, which was just off the chart. And the big question was, is inflation to follow? They need to start clamping down on an inflation prospect that could really drive their economy just out of control. At the same time, their currency, the yuan, is pegged to the U.S. dollar, and there's been a lot, I mean, there's been a worldwide calling for them to start raising that because they want other countries to be more competitive. Now, Europe. Talk about a disaster. This is something that was the big concern when the euro was originally, do you remember back when, I think it was 92, maybe even further back, there was a discussion about how would the euro look if there was major economic slowdowns in individual countries. Now you have each country has their own government, but we have one unifying currency for the area. What happens if there's something that happens with one of the countries and they need to adjust their currency somehow, but they can't? What happens to the rest of the countries? Essentially, that's happening right now. Different than in the U.S., where we have all the different states, let's say, that are operating independently, but we still have one unified government, one unified financial and fiscal policy overriding everything, and we have one currency. There, they have different fiscal policies. They have different labor issues. They have a whole different product line and export and import issues. So what's happening there is when you look at, let's just take, for example, Spain. Spain had a gigantic real estate situation that just bubbled up, blew out, and they just built and overbuilt to a level that is, it almost makes our real estate situation look silly. And that was something that was bubbling behind for a long time, but it went kind of underreported and ignored, swept under the carpet for some time. At the same time, we see Greece. Their budget is terribly out of whack. The Greece government comes out finally when they realize they're getting downgraded and they may be thrown out of the EU in terms of their the EU the euro and the EU ECU and the EU, I should say. And basically what's happening here now with Greece is that they put out an austerity program, and they're looking to this is just amazing. They're looking to slow down on spending by cutting back services dramatically and at the same time raising taxes. So when they cut down on services and a lot more people are unemployed, they raise taxes, they're basically going to try to strip their countrymen of every last dollar they have. And how is that going to help their economy? They say they're going to cut down a 13% GDP to deficit to 3%. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. In a short period of time, the problem is they no longer qualify to be in the EU, and they need to be. Something needs to be done because there's going to be no more. I guess what the best way to look at it is there's no more respect for any of the rules and any of the requirements, because if they do so and let them stay in and lower the standards, I mean, it's back to the moral risk again that you can take any risk you want. If they get bailed out, and I don't wish anything bad for Greece or Italy or Ireland or Portugal or Spain or any of the other countries or the euro itself and the European region. But I got to tell you something. Somebody has to stick up for what is the right thing to do, not only on a morality basis, but also on a fiscally responsible basis. It's getting out of control. Every single time something fails, somebody's behind them. In fact, if you look at what's happening with Spain and why the euro, and that's the next point here, the euro is just getting just hatcheted. Why is that? Well, you have things like all this going on behind the scenes. But at the same time, why did the markets react so positively at about 2:30 in the afternoon on Friday? Because one of the Spanish government officials from Spain came out and said that we will stand behind all the European countries that are in the EU. And you can rest assured that the EU will support them if they need. Now, wait a second. That was weird. The Spanish government is saying that they'll stand behind. Wait a second. Spain, hello. You're one of the problems. I mean, you're one of the issues right now that is causing everybody to be spooked on the euro. So now when you look at what's happening there, you look at the fact that Europe is destabilizing. It's driving money into the dollar because of the safe haven kind of concept, but also away from the euro. And that's causing all sorts of problems and wreaking havoc on the carry trades. And that's causing more issues with the stock market. In addition to that, our housing market here is not stabilizing. There's a lot of talk over the last year that said that once we know that the housing market and employment has stabilized, we know we'll be out of trouble. Well, let's kind of get to the bottom line here. The employment situation has not stabilized. The housing market, by any measure, when you see a 16% drop month over month in pending sales, and then you see the same situation in existing home sales, and you see just really, really very light 1% gains the next month, doesn't show me that we have a stabilized housing yet. We're still losing value on the homes, yes, at a less degree. So in other words, the slope is much less right now. But at the same time, we're still losing value. And finally, I think when you look back and all the different things, and the 10th thing I put down is the healthcare failure. Now, we don't know where this is going right now. We don't know if they're going to revive it. We don't know if it's going to come out in a different form. Of course, Pelosi's talking about it, you know, all the time, that they're going to get something through and read, and everybody's talking about how it's going to be necessary to get something through. But boy, you haven't heard anything about that of late. Now, what I find most disturbing about that from a market standpoint is that we're back to the confusion factor. When we knew we had something going through, and even if it was bad, we knew what it was, or at least we had an idea of what it was. Now we're back to being in a state of confusion in an unknown area. We don't know what's going to happen. And it also makes our government look very weak. It makes it look like the bill was not a quality bill, but they're willing to cram it down our throats And now when they have a roadblock in there, they realize that, you know what, we can't just push something through. We have to have something that has guts, something that has good standing on its own merits, not just because, for whatever reason, the Democrats want to stand behind our president right now. So those are kind of things that are going on. Now, in addition, I want to kind of segue into a discussion about a couple of different things. Let me kind of mention right now that I mentioned this before, and we've had a number of people that have taken us up on this, but I want to make sure that you do this. And this is, in all seriousness, we didn't get as many people as I thought we would for this. And I always get emails that people want to have a call-in show, and a call-in show, maybe it's not, it's only a few weeks away. It's about 3 weeks away. So maybe people haven't been thinking that it's so, you know, important right then. But here's what I want you to do. If you have a question about a stock, the economy, you have a discussion about your portfolio, whatever it is, this is a friendly kind of place. This is a two-way street. I want you to do me a favor. All I want you to do is call the number that I'm about to give you, leave that question on there, and we're going to have it in the 150th show, which is a few shows from now. And that episode is going to cover all your questions. We got a lot of email questions. People maybe didn't want to come on the phone, so we'll read those. We got a few call-ins on that too. But I want to make sure we have a jam-packed show. So please do this for me. I'd really appreciate it. And personally, I think it'll be pretty exciting for the people listening, because everybody probably has these questions. And if you are embarrassed about doing it, do it anyway. Everybody has the same questions. The phone number to call in is 954-828-2977. Again, that's 954-828-2977. Okay, now, I want to talk about oil. And I want to talk about hedging really quickly. You know, in the book, The Disciplined Investor, which you can pick up over at Amazon, on Kindle, it's over at audible.com. And it's like 15 or bucks or so. And if you get one little point out of here on how to actually hedge your portfolio, there's a whole chapter dedicated to what is hedging all about, how do you do it. We hedged our portfolios over the last number of weeks, and we really were able to successfully mitigate much of the risk that we saw in the markets around the world. And, you know, either we took money off the table using sell stops, or we did something like utilize inverse ETFs, or a combination of the two, or, you know, something that would actually lessen the blow to what's gone on in the markets. And if you're wondering what to do now, it's a good time to start thinking about hedging, maybe not going fully short here because it's still a little bit of momentum, even though we broke through most technical barriers on the downside for major markets. You know, if you want to consider hedging, you need to do it with a plan. So there's a whole chapter dedicated on that. I want to mention that. So we've talked about that in other shows on The Winning Investor as well. So if you're interested in that and you've been thinking about that but don't know what to do, I want you to go pick up a copy of that. Finally, I want to talk about oil, and then we'll get to our guest. You know, there's this cycle of oil. It's much different than probably, I would say, almost any other investment because it's traded much differently. It's traded in big lots by big organizations using a lot of leverage, and there's a couple of ways that you can get in on this, and you have to be very careful. We have been short oil for some time, a few weeks actually, and we rode that pretty much from the high down to the low, probably a buck or so off the low. We closed the position. We like to use the double inverse oil ETFs. It's a UCO is one of them, and SCO is another, and these are double inverse or double to the positive. Of oil. So if oil goes up 10%, this may go up 20 or down 20, depending on how you look at it. The contango issue, which we talked about in previous shows, is a big problem here. But it's interesting to notice what's gone on with oil of late. And a lot of that is really related to the whole dollar strength. You know, you look at the dollar, the euro, the pigs, as we call them, which is P-I-I-G-S, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. And the whole commodity structure has really gotten slammed of late. It again, combining my original 10 discussion points because of the fact that you have, what do you have? You have the dollar moving up, you have maybe China not buying as much, and you start mixing this all together, and what do you get? You get commodities falling off a cliff. Well, oil came down and really was pretty hard hit last week when it went down and breached the 69.75 or something like that per barrel. And quickly turned around when the markets turned around. The dollar started losing value against the euro and other currencies towards the end of the day. We do believe that oil does, and we're not big oil fans. We think that the long-term trend for oil could be down, especially if you have a lot of these environmental discussions going on of keeping the world green and using less oil and being less dependent on oil. And we're going to see that in a number of years from now. But it's slowly but surely taking form. We see hybrid cars out there. We see a variety of other clean initiatives. We have wind power and solar power and a variety of other electricity creation other than the traditional ways of doing so. So, you know, when we look at that, we say, what is the real future for oil? Well, the only thing about oil is that there is the possibility that there is a finite reserve of that. We know that. But at the same time, we kind of have to extend that out sometime by the less use of it over time. So I want you to look at oil and look at some of this. We're going to put a chart on the show notes. Of course, just that's at the disciplinedinvestor.com. Each show has its own show notes. We put a lot of the details in the back story about what's happening, about our guests, about the things we talk about on there, the stocks we talk about, et cetera. So in this week's, I'm going to put a chart of oil in there and kind of show you the ranges you may want to look at for buying and selling right now. And we went long oil. We will hold it only a short period of time if it moves against us. But we were short oil for a while, made about 18% on that because we got the double. And we went long oil on Friday, as a matter of fact, when it hit about 70, which is a real important point for the oil traders. That line in the sand of 70 is very, very important. And most oil traders on the bullish side don't want that to go under that, and they will defend that pretty well. So we picked up a little bit of oil in the form of a double on the ProShares two times oil. And you can't hold that for a long period of time because you get a degradation of the value due to contango. And also the leveraged kind of has a weird way of calculating. We've talked about that on a daily basis. So I want you to consider that, look at that, look at the chart. And maybe that's something you want to look at and kind of play that if you're looking to kind of dip your toes into a little bit of swing trading, because I think oil right now is going to be pretty volatile. And that really is all about the dollar issue and how the dollar is reacting to all of the things that are going on around the world. But if, in fact, we get a little bit of peace from governments possibly having major bankruptcies over the short term, you may see oil returning, especially due to some of the cold weather issues and some of the things we're seeing in the economy, and not to mention the bull in the oil pits always seem to like to move that pretty fast. So with that in mind, we covered everything, I think, here. Let's just look. Technology, great. Talked about the call-in show. Again, let me give you that number real quick, 954-828-2977. We talked about the commodities, my top 10. Okay, good. We're in good shape. So lastly, before we get to the guest, if you do want to become a client or you want to see how we manage money, you can take that virtual tour. It's a 14-minute tour. We're actually in the process of updating that. It's going to be pretty cool. We're going to get a really nice-looking thing. But if you want to check out how we manage money, why we manage money, what we do here, we do have a $50,000 minimum per account for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. I want you to go to the show notes. We'll put a big, fat link right there, and you can go see the virtual tour where I take you through all the ways that we invest money and how we invest money and what we do, et cetera. I think you'll find that interesting. Right at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on show notes, and you'll find it right there. You know, what we do also is, by the way, on the front page of the Disciplined Investor, always at the top of the page is the latest podcast. You can just click there and find the information from there. All right, so we're done with that, and let's get to our guest. We'll kind of set it up, we'll give him a call, and we'll be right back. Thanks for listening. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Up next, Eric Savitz. And welcome back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And I have an old friend, not old, but a friend that I haven't talked to in a while. And that's the kind of old we're talking about here. He is an excellent writer, really covers the entire technology beat for Barron's, and has a blog, The Tech Trader, which is barron's.com/tech trader. His name is Eric Savitz. We haven't heard from him in a while. We're going to talk about technology. Eric, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Great. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It has been a while.
I know. We got to do this a little more often, possibly. So there's so many things to talk about in the technology world. You know, the technology area has been, in this general market environment, seen the first leg down of whatever is going on right now. But I thought I'd talk about some of the good news that we've seen out there and really the question of why we haven't seen the follow-through when it comes through to the, you know, the general markets. If you recall, was last quarter or so, that Intel came out with any smidgen of information that looked good, the entire world exploded better. This time we see things like an Intel or even a Cisco that we just saw late in the week last week come out, and John Chambers has some great things to say. He's very encouraged, which is not necessarily what you always see with John Chambers, and that doesn't help anything. What's going on?
Well, I think there's a couple things at work here. So the good news is the fundamentals do seem to be improving, and we've been seeing that all through the Q4 earnings period. We saw good numbers from Cisco, and before that from Microsoft and from Intel and from AMD and from Seagate and from IBM and from Apple. All of the major tech companies, particularly those that serve the PC market and companies that serve corporate IT customers, all reported almost universally strong numbers, better than expected numbers, impressive guidance. There was really very little to complain about. Cisco is the most recent one, and it was really way better than expected for the quarter. Their quarter ends in January, so the numbers are actually a little bit more recent than some of the others. And their guidance for the April quarter was for pretty impressive growth. They're looking at 23 to 26% growth year over year in their quarter that ends in April. That's very difficult to complain about. They said they saw improvement across the board, whether by geography or by customer segment or by product line. They saw a pickup in demand from the enterprise in the U.S. and from carrier customers, and they're seeing some turnaround in Europe, and there was really very little to complain about. So right. You raise an obvious question. Why aren't stocks reacting? And I think there's really two parts to that. Now, first of all, you have to remember that many tech stocks had a very impressive move in 2009 off the bottom in March. Some stocks doubled, there are stocks that tripled. We had very large gains across the board in all segments of technology. Mm-hmm. You saw it even with the largest cap names, Apple doubled, Microsoft doubled. Very impressive moves by many stocks. And the moves came despite a year in which by almost any measure, demand was not very good. You know, we saw a decline in declining demand in PCs and semiconductors and a whole bunch of other things in technology. But what you were seeing was anticipation of a turnaround, and the turnaround began to emerge as the year went on. You know, Cisco pegs the bottom as really almost a year ago, early in 2009, and things have gradually improved. Mm-hmm. First, we saw them get less bad, then they started to actually turn, and we're now seeing a positive comparison. So effectively, what we're doing here is a giant case of sell on the news. That's not very comforting if when you see really good numbers and the market nonetheless sells off. I think there are some other things at work. There are other kinds of worries in the broader economy. There's some still concerns about high rates of unemployment. There are worries about the possibility of new taxes. There are concerns about the financial health of some markets in Europe, in particular in Greece, where they're worried about about a possible debt default. So there's a whole bunch of other things that have nothing to do with tech whatsoever that are weighing on the market and pulling tech down with it as some investors take advantage of the big moves that they saw in 2009 and take some profit.
So when we look at, first of all, John Chambers is not known to be the ultimate optimist, right? He usually keeps it relatively subdued, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And in fact, you can actually date the beginning of the downturn in the economy and in the markets to some remarks that Chambers made really before anyone else realized there was going to be a downturn. I mean, Chambers made some remarks on a conference call, much like the one he held this week after they reported earnings, where he basically said they were seeing some softness in the U.S. enterprise market. Well, that triggered a sell-off in the market, and,
yep.
And Chambers was very early in seeing a turnaround. Now, Chambers has been sounding relatively upbeat for the last few quarters. I would say that he's been trying to balance both a desire to be cautious with mm-hmm. his own, I think, feelings that things in fact really are getting better fundamentally for Cisco and for tech spending generally. He's not someone who typically is a wild-eyed bull, but he tells it like he sees it, and I think right now he's seeing pretty good demand. Now, you know, as you say, the stock is not really responding to that. You know, there was an interesting comment on the conference call on Wednesday when one of the analysts said something like, "Well, if this, if these numbers don't move the market, there's really something wrong." And mm-hmm. of course, they didn't move the market. And
right.
And there are things wrong, but the things that are wrong have nothing to do with Cisco or router sales or tech stocks in particular, but have more to do with some larger dynamics in the economy. And
I think some of that has to do with when we saw Microsoft's earnings last week come out, or the week before it came out. I was very interested in that because what you saw was we knew there was going to be about a $1.4 billion carryover from the deferred sales of Windows 7 with the upgrade. So we knew that. But they also beat numbers, and they beat pretty handily in terms of what was going on. But the thing that was really a problem, and where the real negative issue was when it came to Microsoft, as I saw it, was their business segment. And they even discussed on the conference call that they didn't see any significant demand, nor did they see an outlook that there's a significant demand in the business market compared to where they think they should have been. I think that also, when you add that to some of the other discussions about the U.S.-based business as compared to maybe China or Asia, I should say, and some of the other areas of the world, is that, do you think, weighing a bit?
I think that you have a point. I mean, I think that in particular Microsoft, if you drill down on what they were saying, I think Microsoft was indicating that PC sales in particular have had a nice pickup from the consumer side of the business, but remain soft on the enterprise side, and that actually echoes some comments that we heard earlier in the quarter from companies like Intel and Seagate, where they're seeing very strong demand from consumers who, despite whatever issues they might have with joblessness and other issues with the economy, are nonetheless continuing to buy PCs. Now, part of that may be because pricing on PCs has come down, but nonetheless, there's still very strong demand for PCs from the consumer. Now, mm-hmm. on the enterprise side, it's taking a little longer. I mean, I think that's one reason why, frankly, the Cisco results are, to many people, so encouraging. It suggests that there really is some thawing of IT spending. I think on the PC side, we are going through a pretty typical process where IT departments evaluate the new version of Windows, Windows 7, which is only a few months old. Typically, I think that it takes a year or so for IT departments at large companies to feel comfortable with new operating systems, so they want to make sure all the bugs are worked out of the system before they start rolling them out. Certainly, if you buy a new PC today, it will have Windows 7 almost certainly. And there's also, I think, some belief, and I think for a good reason, that the corporate PC installed base is aging, and that there's an upgrade cycle coming. Mm-hmm. But the expectation has been that it'll be a second half phenomenon, and so that still seems to be the way people are thinking. So in fact, well, one way to look at it is that there's some concern about the fact that spending on PCs from the enterprise has been a little softer than people might have hoped. I think on the other hand, this is some added fuel that we get to tech spending in the second half, and it should keep the numbers from the street pretty good as we go into the second half of 2010. Mm-hmm. And I think that's particularly true for all the companies in the PC food chain. I've been writing some bullish things in my column about companies like Intel and Microsoft and Seagate, and I think they will have a very good year. And it could have some legs. I mean, I think that both on the consumer side and the enterprise side, there's reasons to get excited about the PC market, both in terms of the new operating system, Windows 7, which is getting very good reviews. There's a new generation of processors from Intel. There's some interesting new form factors from the PC manufacturers, including not just netbooks, but also tablets and other kinds of devices. Mm-hmm. So I think there's reason to feel good about that for the long term. Right, you know, of course, right now
sure.
in the market,
sure.
we're not seeing
not,
it.
Yeah,
not seeing
happy.
The love, exactly.
exactly. So let's. I want to save the juicy question about Apple and Google for a moment, because I know we're pressed for time here. I want to ask you something about solid-state drives and the whole idea of hard drives in general. You know, Moore's Law, we know that generally in technology, that what do we see? A doubling of capacity and halving of the price every 6 months or so. That's been the general
right.
discussion, particularly when it comes to processors, et cetera, and semiconductors. But what we're seeing is we saw a real kind of move towards this solid-state drive, which is essentially a gigantic compact flash drive for anybody that hasn't really thought of that before and what it could do. So you may have a hard drive instead of having a 200 gigabyte hard drive from Seagate or Western Digital that spins and that, you know, it's doing a laser to find the actual point on the platter. And that obviously is sensitive. And if you knock that around, it could ruin it. What you have instead is a gigantic solid state drive. We saw a couple of companies, one of them called STEC, S-T-E-C, that came out with that primarily for backup and SAN, but for a few different places. But what's going to happen in this environment? A lot of people are thinking that everybody's going towards the solid state and going to leave behind their traditional, you know, platters and disks. But it seems to me that that's not necessarily happening. It's a bit of a hybrid approach. I mean, have you looked into this?
Yeah, you know, so I have written quite a bit about this. I think there's a couple of issues here. So solid-state drives are certainly beginning to be seen in various kinds of devices, and there's really kind of two broad markets here. One is for in PCs, as you say, as replacement for magnetic media for spinning disk drives, and then the other is in the enterprise storage market. Now, STEC, the company you mentioned. It has largely been targeting the enterprise storage market, and mm-hmm. There are some kind of niche applications there in which, for example, you might have, say, a very large storage array, and you might have some data stored in solid-state drives, which are basically flash memory arrays. Because there's very fast seek times, you can pull the data up quickly, you don't have to spin up physical media, but it's still... you know, if you look at it on a per byte basis, it's much more expensive than mm-hmm. magnetic media
right.
to this day. And so, so while it's sort of appealing not to have the risk of mechanical failures that you have, say, with a typical disk drive, the costs involved make it not practical yet to replace disk drives with flash drives for most purposes. And the cost, if you try to do, the other thing that's happening, of course, is that the amount of storage on the average PC or notebook gets bigger and bigger. To replace the same amount of storage with an equal amount of flash storage in the form of a solid-state drive
right.
would be prohibitively expensive. So you're seeing them in niche applications, devices where you might not want to have, a spinning drive. So a good example would be, for example, the Apple iPad
mm-hmm.
Has no conventional hard drive. All the storage is in flash.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the largest memory version of the iPad, I believe, is 64 gig. Even a low-end notebook now comes with 80.
Right.
There are some applications for the technology, but the disk drive market is far from dead. In fact, if you talk to Seagate or Western Digital, they at this point are actually capacity constrained. They have more demand for disk drives than
interesting.
They can sell.
So let's go segue right into the Apple tablet for a second, the iPad. A lot of people calling it the iFlop. There is a whole laundry list of issues that they seemingly forgot. And that drove down the stock pretty dramatically once we found out that some of these things were missing, like a front-facing camera, no multitasking. It's going to be the iPhone OS where, you have the limitations there. Everybody thought it may be some kind of a hybrid between a Mac OS and an iPhone OS. And magically, of course, we saw the Rumor Patrol come out and said they're already working on a larger tablet with front-facing camera, with all these other things, much more on a Mac OS style. Now, I don't know if those are Apple fanboys or Apple, option owners on the call side or what it is. It doesn't seem like to me that just from what I know about Apple, Apple doesn't do things and then just change their mind so quickly. And when they do things, they use a lot of thought in it. And if they're going to come out with a new product, that would have been something that we would have heard about possibly some time ago, not just to almost rescue the situation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's way too early to start thinking about what the next version of the iPad might be. You know, the device, I went to the launch earlier this month. I mean, the device is in many ways very compelling. It's a nice form factor. It's a nice crisp screen. It's a really comfortable way to browse the web. It's a pretty impressive ebook reader. There are some issues, as you said. There's no front-facing camera. It doesn't use flash. Which is true in large part because it's true for the iPhone OS, which is what it's based on. It does, on the other hand, run almost any application in the App Store, so there's instantly 140,000 applications you can run. Mm-hmm. Apple is encouraging people to write apps specifically for the iPad. You know, it does a nice job displaying movies, so you can use it for iTunes. There's some other things you can't do. You know, you can't make phone calls on it. You can't, as you said, there's no camera, so you can't do chat.
No USB, no plug-in.
There's no USB. Right. There is an adapter that they sell for cameras, so there's a way to download pictures onto it. And so, you know, they faced some of the same kind of criticisms, actually, when they launched the MacBook Air, which lacked some ports and a few other things. I think one thing to keep in mind here is that the price point is very compelling. You know, you can buy the low-end version at, you'll be able to buy the low-end version for $499. They also have fairly reasonable data plans that they arrange through AT&T. Now, some people are unhappy that they chose to do this through AT&T, you know, given some of the issues that have come up.
Which is about 90% of that's 90% of the AT&T users now. But go ahead, continue.
Yes. Well, people were not happy with that part of the with that choice. People were kind of hoping they would do a deal with Verizon. But nonetheless, I think it's a little too early to call it the iFail. I mean, there's going to be a lot of initial demand. You know, the device doesn't ship until the end of March for the version that's Wi-Fi only. And if you want the version with 3G. Which, frankly, I think is the version that most people will want, so that you have kind of ubiquitous connectivity. You're going to have to wait another month, so late April. So it's going to be 3 months, and then figure in, you know, a couple of months after that until we get some really good data on how it's doing. So it's going to be a while before we can fairly evaluate it. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind there are other tablet devices that are coming. There were a whole host.
There's a lot of them. No, there's a lot.
Yes.
That was amazing when they did
HP,
the Windows. Oh,
yeah, got some buzz out of on there. So, in fact, Steve Ballmer showed it off for a few seconds on stage at CES during his keynote there. There's some other, you know, there's some other stuff coming in the tablet space, but of course, none of them will run. None of the others are going to run iPhone apps or, you know, iTunes, etc. So. You know, there are certainly drawbacks to the device. I think, in particular, flash is one that people find aggravating, in particular because so many of the video and game applications that run on the web are run in flash, so you can't run them on the iPad. But that said, it's a pretty nice device. We'll see how it fits in. I mean, I think that the use case is interesting because it's not a phone. It's not a full-fledged laptop. It does not have a full, you know, of course, as a tablet, it doesn't have a physical keyboard. So, but as if you're traveling, if you just want to have another way to access the net at home without having to, you know, turn on your PC, I can see some interesting opportunities there. But also, I would keep a real close eye on what they're doing in the books market. You know, they've already kind of created a furor by changing using a different pricing model for books than the one that Amazon has been using on the Kindle. And it's kind of forcing Amazon to change the way they price books on the Kindle, which is interesting. And meanwhile, you know, Apple's also holding some discussions reportedly with a bunch of textbook publishers. I could see that this could be a very compelling device if you happen to be, say, a college student and can have you know, one simple device to carry around all your textbooks on, as opposed to having to lug around, you know, a pile of very expensive hardcover books.
So, right, but the latest revelation is that Amazon bought a Screen Touch, a company that specializes in touchscreen technology. Did you see that?
Yes, I did. They bought a little company called TouchGo, which is a little spin out of a media lab at NYU. It's a very small company. It's like half a dozen employees. Doesn't have any products yet. It's very early stage, but it is a sign that Amazon has some, you know,
a little
you
battle.
Know, new
a little
plans battle. For the new plans for the Kindle. I don't think we've seen the last version of the Kindle.
Right.
And you have to remember also, you know, Amazon also recently announced that they are opening up the APIs for the Kindle, essentially providing developers' kits to let people develop applications for the Kindle. Now, you have to remember that the Kindle with the current e-ink display is hardly ideal for, say, you know, things like gaming. It's, you know, it's a monochrome display. It's it doesn't refresh very quickly. It's a nice way to read books. It's not necessarily a great way to do much of anything else. So, you know, they may be games, but they're more likely to be, say, crossword puzzles.
Yeah, exactly. Like paper alternatives. I know you got to go. I got to ask you about Google, but one thing I want to say is that the Apple iPhone, the greatness of the Apple iPhone, there's a few things, but one of the greatness of pieces of what happened there was, and we talk about the iPad of what is it going to be, what's the application, what's the usability, but the real genius behind it was two things, in my opinion. It was the touchscreen, of course, the ease to use in general, but it was clearly the App Store.
Yeah.
I mean, so who knows what's going to be the next thing that we see from the iPad or from Amazon that will really take that product to the next level, whatever that is. Real quick.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that is true is, you know, the App Store has launched, you know, an impressive flurry of other App Stores.
So, right.
I mean, all the handset makers have one. Intel even announced a MacBook App Store at CES.
Wow.
So. Lots of app stores.
Fabulous for independent contractors that can write, program, and can code. Fabulous.
Absolutely.
Real quick, Google, staying in China or coming out?
Oh, you know, my suspicion is that they'll figure out a way to stay. I mean, in some form. Now, you know, they I think, are not likely to be as big a force in China as they might have been otherwise. You know, they've taken kind of a principled stand. You know, it's not a big revenue impact at this point. It does affect their ability to take advantage of what is, you know, kind of the biggest untapped market or undertapped, if that's a word, market in the world. You know, I think it was a surprising move in many ways. We'll see. I mean, there are some analysts who are convinced that they're really just going to pull out. Now, pulling out, you have to be careful what that actually means. There'll still be a Chinese, you know, there will still be a Mandarin language version of Google. Probably there still will be. It just won't be operated from within the country. So, you know, that it'll be subject to whatever filtering software the Chinese government puts on incoming traffic. So it'll be a different situation operating outside the country. And, you know, people will be able to, there'll still be a Google in Mandarin of some kind. We'll see. I mean, I think you could still, you know, in some ways I think it's still a coin flip. I suspect in the end that they will figure out a way to operate, within the country in a way that, creates some kind of compromise with the Chinese, mm-hmm. but we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it's good for shareholders. Let me say one thing in closing. Do you know that when they opened it up, when there was no more, the cloak of the Chinese government having their oversight and Google released the confines of the search and opened up for anything. Do you know what the I don't know if you saw this, but the highest search the first day, second day was inside of China on Google?
No.
It was the phrase, the real story of Tiananmen Square.
Fascinating.
Isn't that cool?
Fascinating. And I think it's certainly a sign that, you know, you've got a very interesting combination in China of a an economy that's growing dramatically and where the government is trying to encourage the economy to grow. But at the end of the day, it's still a, you know, it's still a government that has exercises tremendous control over its population. And you see it in funny ways. I mean, you know, you saw it in Google. There's another recent example in the video gaming business where they some arm of the Chinese government decided to enforce a rule that said you can't have online games in China that aren't produced in China. And it's created some real problems for Activision, which is the parent company of the World of Warcraft game.
Yep.
And their licensee in China has been fighting to keep the game online, where you know, it has a large fan base.
So yep,
there's all sorts of funny things that happen when you get involved with China. But on the other hand, there are not very many markets with the kind of unbelievable growth potential that China offers. I think people are going to try and stay there if they can.
I hear you. Eric Savage, he's the tech writer for Barron's Magazine. He writes a blog. It's the barrons.com/tech trader. It's the Tech Trader Daily.
Tech Trader Daily.
Just look it up. This guy writes, you just put your RSS feed on there because you want to read his articles every single week. Brilliant guy. You know, I've always tried in every conversation to get a little something in there that he didn't know, but I can never do it. Anyway, just a little something. But one of these days, I'll figure out some little company that's really obscure that something's going on, and you'll say, oh, I never heard of that. But anyway, thanks a lot, Eric. We'll talk to you real soon, my friend.
My pleasure.
All right, bye-bye. So lots to think about there. Lots of things going on in the world of technology. Eric Savage, great guy. And I'll keep in touch with him and try to bring him back soon. Don't forget, next week is Harry Dent. And make sure to be listening to that. Send me any questions that you want to, of course, ask him. I'll try to ask him when we do the show. And if you do want to be on episode number 150, which is a call-in show, I really, really, really want to make this pretty jam-packed, as packed as possible with questions. Anything you have in mind, anything you've ever thought about asking me, just call in 954-828-2977. That's a voicemail line. So you'll just leave a message and we'll get that recorded and call you back, or just, you know, put that right on. And I'll answer the question. Thanks for listening. This is Andrew Horowitz. Check out the show notes, disciplinedinvestor.com. And don't forget, every Monday we put the indicators we're watching on there. And if you don't have a subscription for the RSS feed or Twitter, that's where you get the fastest information from the Disciplined Investors blog. Because we write, I don't know, 5, 4, 5, 8 different posts a day on the economics, on stocks, giving you ideas, what's happening. And I think you'll really enjoy that. So we'll see you next week. I hope you have a very, very warm one, and we see what's going on up there this week in the Baltimore northeastern region of the United States. Boy, that looks awful. That looks awful. And I hope you enjoy the week ahead. Be safe. Be smart. Invest for profit. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.